Welcome to the X-Cast X-Files Podwatch, episode 97, covering Hellbound and Provenance. I'm your host, Darren Mooney, and with me is author, writer, and expert, that's with an X and a hyphen, Chris Knowles. How are you, Chris?
Doing good. Doing good. It's always good to be talking to Darren Mooney.
It is indeed. It's always a pleasure to be talking to Chris Knowles as well. Last time we talked, I think, was at the end of the eighth season. So I think you stuck the gap between the eighth and the ninth season, and I sort of chickened out at the end of the eighth. So how has the ninth season been going for you, Chris?
I came into the ninth season without a great deal of expectation, and I was entertained. I don't think it's, you know, the greatest series of television ever produced, but I really don't think it's nearly as bad as a lot of people seem to think.
Right. Now, well, I mean, I'm going to be honest, coming back to it myself, because I had a similar experience. I think that when I was watching it, it's sort of, my enthusiasm had sort of sapped. I don't even think I watched all the episodes in first run. But I think that when I came back and watched it again, what I found that I didn't expect to find was that the standalones in the ninth season were actually quite good for me. I actually quite enjoyed a lot of them. Like, I liked 4D, I liked Audrey Pauly, I liked John Doe, for example. And I liked this one as well, the one we're going to talk about today, which is Hellbound, which is actually, just to get some details for the listeners, it's the eighth episode of the ninth season. It's directed by Kim Manners. It's written by David Amann, who I would argue is one of the stronger of sort of the later stage X-Files writers. And basically this aired in January 2002. And it was around the time, I think, that this was the point at which I think Fox and Chris Carter together sort of decided that they're going to wrap down the X-Files. So this is sort of the end of the show, the end of the year. And I actually quite like Hellbound, I have to admit.
Yeah, I really do too. I don't think it's grade A standalone. I don't even think it's one of the better or the best ninth season standalones. And there is the whole Monica Reyes subplot that I think drags the thing down a bit, but you know, overall it's got, you know, it's feature film quality cinematography. Sherry Montesano Metcalf won an Emmy for the makeup effects. I really have to say that no matter how the scripts went, Robert Patrick was just superlative this season. You know, very strong performer. So I mean, like I said, there are major issues that I have with it, but overall, I think it's a fairly strong standalone.
Well, I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned the production there, because like one of the things that I wasn't majorly fond of in going, there are a lot of things I wasn't majorly fond of in going from the eighth to the ninth season, but one of the things is the production of the ninth season tends to be a lot more sort of like colorful and bright. But one of the things I like about this episode about Hellbound is that it's very dark and it's very grisly. It's got that excellent use of like shadow that you got during the eighth season, which you hadn't really seen since the Vancouver era. Like, the opening scene is set in a church, for example. It's got that sort of, like, that rich sort of religious iconography element to it, where even if the script isn't as tight as it could be, and it's very vague and it's very abstract, and it's almost like the rough outline of an X-File rather than the X-File itself, but it does have that kind of, it does have that feel, that texture that's almost kind of hard to describe. Like, it feels like an early X-Files almost. It feels almost like a lost first or second season episode. Maybe it's because it's set in an abattoir, which, you know, reminds me a lot of, say, Red Museum or Our Town or whatever. But it does have that sort of pulpy, old-school feel to me, which I really liked about it.
And there's also the subplot, you know, the fifth wheel subplot with Scully going to see the detective, which reminds me of Squeeze and Tombs.
Oh, the history of the history of the case and sort of the old picture and the fact that this is an evil that has been around repeatedly since the dawn of time and stuff. And it is, because it actually has, I really like that, like the idea of it going back to like the formation of the country, like it being like an original sin almost of America, this perpetual cycle of like violence and murder, and the idea that the killer then sort of escapes and it just continues and perpetuates itself, which is something that's very... Like, I don't want to say that it went away, because it obviously didn't go away when you had the mythology in the eighth and ninth seasons, but it does remind me a lot of what Carter was doing around, say, the second and third season with, say, Anasazi, and with, say, you know, Paperclip and stuff like that, where there was this idea that, like, American history in some ways was, like, cycles of violence sort of repeating themselves almost, that everything, like, the nation's original sin was the colonization by the European settlers and stuff. And I kind of like that aspect of the story. It does... Despite the fact it focuses on Reyes, and I think we may actually talk a little bit about how it focuses on Reyes, but I like the fact that as plot-wise and thematically, it feels like an earlier episode. Because you sort of mentioned earlier, you're not a big fan of how it uses Reyes.
Here's the thing. there was such confusion in this season about what to do with her. A lot of it had to do with the way she was originally conceived and probably Fox's reaction to how she was originally conceived. You know, we saw her in Existence, and she's sort of this goofy, you know, she's crooning whale song and she's kind of flirting with Scully. I mean, there were all these sort of undertones and subtexts going on in that, you know, that I know the Scully-Reyes relationship fangirls were big fan of that particular episode. But, you know, her character, I really liked the way her character was introduced in the eighth season. And the way her sort of good-natured, new age, you know, she was supposed to be what Chris Carter called a source of light, you know, that she was supposed to lighten up the stories. You're supposed to be not exactly comic relief, but a character that kind of...
She didn't have the trauma of, say, Doggett or Mulder, where it's like a lost family behind her. And she also didn't have, like, the trauma that Scully had accrued with the abduction and everything. She was basically like a clean slate, I think, maybe.
Yeah, I think that's very well said. So what happens in the ninth season is, over the summer, there's a lot of talk that Reyes is a lesbian. And I think that John Scheiben sort of addressed that later on, saying, well, that's sort of how we envisioned her, but then we didn't go with that. Because, you know, what we see, like, in Nothing Happened, whatever. Nothing Important Happened. I call that episode Nothing Interesting Happened this episode. You know, the first time we see Reyes appear in that episode, you know, she's, like, topless, and she all of a sudden has a boyfriend. It's, like, the very first minute. It's, like, so you know that Fox has said, forget it. You know, give her a boyfriend, you know, give her a completely heterosexual backstory, you know, start playing up the sexual tension with Doggett. I mean, like, her character was just totally repurposed. And the problem with this episode is that, you know, Frank Spotnitz had told David Iman that he wanted to add a little darkness to Reyes. Now, the problem, you know, we see here, like, that Chris and Frank are not really on the same page with this character. They're sort of almost at odds. There's a lot of back and forth going on with this character. She just gets lost. And I really feel bad for Annabeth Gish. In this particular episode, I see this whole subplot with the reincarnation and, you know, the those themes that you allude to. I think it probably would have been more effective if the woman who ran the support group was the one who was, you know, reincarnating and things like that. Because pinning that on Reyes just seems like such a tack on. Just seems like typical kind of television stuff. No, you know, the drama has to be driven by the main characters. And that's not necessarily how the X-Files always works. And I don't think that it's necessarily how the X-Files works best.
I think you've made this point before, actually, which is something that I would kind of agree with, which is that in the early episodes, you frequently had Mulder and Scully investigating cases involving other people. But as the show sort of progressed, and it sort of, I think, happened, you point to it as one of the things that happened with the move to LAX, I think, it's that the show then sort of, the X-Files stopped being about things that happened to people that Mulder and Scully sort of wandered into their lives and out of their lives. And the X-Files started happening a lot more frequently to Mulder and Scully themselves, in that they became became more caught up in the stories, and the stories inevitably revolved around them rather than them sort of being investigators going off and encountering these sort of eccentric spaces and these eccentric characters that had their own lives and their own sort of spells almost, you know?
That's exactly the way I feel about this subplot in Hellbound. I think this would have been a much stronger episode if it focused on the woman who led the support group in the way that a lot of X-Files do, where characters who are sort of the center of the action, you know, form this kind of bond with Mulder and Scully in the old days, and Doggett and Reyes in this context. If they framed it in that context, I think it would have just been a much stronger episode. And that's sort of my problem in some ways with the ninth season, is that it almost seems like they're just clearing the decks of leftover scripts, and they're putting, you know, I mean, Doggett is in a coma or the hospital or, you know,
every other episode.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, and then, you know, I mean, he's in a coma, and then Reyes is in a coma. It's just like, it just seems a little too, you know, again, there's that word contrived.
Soap opera-y, perhaps, then.
Yeah, it just starts to feel, You know, it's interesting. In this episode, Patrick Swayze's brother, Don, is one of the co-stars, one of the guest stars. And that's kind of the way I see this episode and the ninth season in general. It's like, you know, it kind of looks like Patrick Swayze. You know, he's a good actor. He's not a great actor. And he just doesn't have Patrick's charisma. And that's kind of like, yeah. You know, it's a great metaphor. It's like, this is kind of like The X-Files. It's well done. It's well acted. You know, it just doesn't have that charisma. It doesn't have that spark.
So Providence is the ninth episode of the ninth season. It's written by both Chris Carter and Frank Spotnitz. It's directed by Kim Manners. It is a mythology episode arriving pretty much smack bang in the middle of the season. And it's not an episode of which I am particularly fond. One of the things about the ninth season mythology is that there's a lot of it on paper that is quite interesting and quite clever. Because obviously, like, this was immediately after 9/11. I think, as you pointed out before, 9/11 happened while they were filming Demonicus.
Yes.
Frank Spotnitz was doing his directorial debut. Like, in no way was the ninth season planned before after 9/11 had happened or anything like that. So they were sort of thinking on their feet and improvising. But you can sort of see in some of the scripts in the ninth season, I think, an attempt to figure out a response to 9/11. Like, which is something catastrophic and horrible and completely, like, I don't live in America, but when it happened, it was completely outside my own frame of reference. And it's sort of to imagine trying to continue writing The X-Files at a time when that had happened, and trying to do it in such a way that, like, you'd written and filmed the season premiere before it happened, and then they're being broadcast after it happened, and having to sort of catch up with that. It's a very daunting idea, but there are elements in the ninth season that I quite like that try to engage with that. So you get, like, the idea of surveillance culture and, like, trust no one. You get, like, Mulder's trip to Gitmo, basically, in The Truth, which is one of my favourite parts of the episode, and I feel is horribly underdeveloped. I think that even with Providence and Providence, you can sort of see shades, I think, of maybe Carter and Spotnitz playing with that. So it's got this idea of, like, religion, which is an old sort of X-Files kind of saw, but this idea of sort of fanaticism and cultism. But you also have, and this is kind of interesting, this idea of, like, borders and boundaries, which is also another X-Files saw when you talk about hybridization, colonization. But you have, like, this idea of, like, intense border patrol at Canada, at the border of Canada, which I think is where, contrary to popular opinion, or contrary to what you'd expect, after 9/11, I believe there was heightened security on the border of Canada, like, because that was how they feared potential terrorists would be coming in, not through Mexico, as some people would expect, through the sort of smugglers or the coyotes or whatever. But apparently there was a big worry about people coming in from Canada. And, like, there is that sort of element that plays through it, but it's so lifeless. It's so dull.
I actually beg to differ a bit on this. It's understated. It's very dark. It's very moody. I don't know. How can I frame this? Well, first of all, as far as 9/11 goes, I mean, 9/11, you know, happened here. I mean, it happened where I am. I mean, the actual event happened in New York. And strangely enough, I was actually working in Lower Manhattan. I was taking the path to World Trade Center all the time in early September. And for some reason, I had that day off. I was working for a production company in Lower Manhattan on Lafayette Street. So that was kind of eerie and disturbing. And also, a very good friend of mine lived across the street from World Trade Center on South End Avenue. And at the time, I mean, literally at the time, again, early September, we were working on a movie screenplay together. So when I wasn't taking, you know, the path into World Trade Center, I was taking the ferry to World Trade Center, you know, around the same time. And you know, for some strange reason, I don't even remember the reason or the context or what happened that day, but I wasn't in New York that day, even though I had been, you know, the entire previous week. So that was just, like, really eerie and disturbing. And the other point I was trying to make is that, you know, so many people from this area, from this part of New Jersey, were killed in that event, you know, including people I knew. I mean, it was very much something that happened here. So I think that's one of the reasons why I didn't end up watching the X-Files until it was in reruns, because it was just, you know, such a mass trauma that, you know, nobody was in the mood to watch stories about government conspiracies at that time. Anyway, the point I'm trying to make here is that I think, you know, that sort of maybe made, you know, when I did go back and watch it, gave it a little bit more sting or punch or, you know, however you want to frame it. Here's the thing. I remember in the sixth season, the end of sixth season, Biogenesis, just being just utterly blown away by the last shot of that that.
The spaceship, isn't it? The guard ship, basically, the pullback of Scully on the
beach. Yeah, and basically what we're seeing here is that we're seeing, you know, it's sort of the climax of Scully's arc. Now, I see the X-Files as basically the story of Scully. And, you know, it's Scully's journey from being this really kind of typically obnoxious skeptic type in the first season, you know, very knee-jerk, you know, it's almost kind of like a denialist, and just how her character grows, you know, throughout the storylines and evolves. And what we see in Biogenesis here, and I don't think most people recognize it as such, but we're basically seeing, you know, this is the big moment. This is when Scully gets what she has always sought, what she's always said she wanted. And that is proof of, you know, that these things that Mulder is telling her are, you know, this is the proof that all that stuff is actually real. I mean, you had that great Mark Snow score. The expectations for me were incredibly high at the end of that sixth season. And then it's just like, I mean, I really do like the six extinction episodes, but in some ways it's like kind of like, I don't know, it's just kind of like they dropped the ball. It's like they didn't,
they sort of changed direction almost, I think, in some ways. You could sort of pick it up.
Yeah, they didn't follow through with how momentous this really was. And I think that's a function of just the chaos behind the scenes in the seventh season.
I was going to say, yeah, you had the lawsuit happening and everything like that. You had the question of whether or not it was going to be the final season.
Yeah, it was. Things were really bad behind the scenes, and there's a lot of bad feeling between, you know, the principals. With the Sixth Extinction, I really believe that the original intent was to create a new mythology. It was to create a sort of a new, improved mythology that was a bit more, maybe a bit more philosophical, a bit more mystical, not quite as, you know, Skull and Dagger and James Bond as it had become previously. And I think that, again, I'm not exactly sure why or exactly sure how, but it just seemed to run aground. And it's sort of telling to me that Emma Fati takes the storyline that is essentially about Scully and makes it about Mulder. You know, so because really what we're being set up for is Scully's
conversion.
Yeah, it's like this is her Road to Damascus experience. And then it just sort of runs aground with Amor Fati into just being, you know, about Mulder
and hybrids again, and cigarette smoking man and all this sort of stuff.
Yeah,
stuff that you thought was mostly gone at this point.
So I just think, I mean, again, I'm not exactly sure how or why any of this went down, but I think it's very telling that that Sixth Extinction storyline is picked up again, you know, after David leaves. Again, I can only speculate, but it just seems to be a very interesting turn of events there. So, I appreciate it for that, because I just remember thinking, like, watching the seventh season, it's like, what happened to that storyline in Biogenesis? It's like, there was such a great buildup, and then just, it went nowhere. I found it very interesting that they picked up the storyline. And again, harking back to classic X-Files elements, you know, we sort of get a return to Red Museum, this Josefo character and his cult. So it's almost like the Red Museum cult, you know, had their apotheosis. You know, it's kind of like the subtext of it, and found this ship in Canada. And again, I mean, this is playing out in a completely different cultural context. in 2002 than it would have played out in 1994. You know, the culture has shifted, the zeitgeist has shifted. I mean, really, everything is kind of working against the X-Files at this point in time. Given all that, that's why I sort of like admire the fact that they would be willing to dip back into that well, to revisit that storyline, you know, and go back to what we discussed in the Red Museum, the whole idea of the Order of the Solar Temple, and we see that in the next episode, that it's basically sort of an allegorical replay of the fate of the Solar Temple. So, I mean, again, it's almost like, hey, remember how fun it was back then? I mean, it's very nostalgic in some ways, and I think what you're picking up on is just that sort of last day of school kind of feeling, you know, where it's just like, you know, you don't really care.
We're not going to see each other again. Yeah. Let's just play the oldies. Sort of.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's definitely sort of wistful and nostalgic, but there's a lot that I really do like about this episode. And, you know, a major part of that is Robert Patrick and his performance. I very much like the two-parter. You know, I very much like the sort of themes that they play with. I do have a lot of criticism of it, but I don't know. Again, it's like I'm fonder of the ninth season than a lot of people seem to be, and I think I'm fonder of this two-parter than a lot of people seem to be.
I think you might be. I mean, because I think that, yeah, you're right when you say it has a sort of like a golden oldie, like end of school sort of stuff, where you can see like all the things that have sort of interested people in the past about the X-Files, and all the things that interested Carter in particular. I mean, even the idea of the hospital scene, the hospital set second part, is like something from Redux, something from Memento Mori, you know, something from even Emily in A Christmas Carol. It's like, it's practically a smorgasbord of sort of X-Files sort of mythology elements. But I think one of the things that sort of grinds me a little bit, and it's something that haunts the season as a whole, is the absence of Duchovny, and the sort of the way that the series is still about Mulder, even though Duchovny kind of made it quite clear that he wasn't coming back. So I mean, like, this episode builds the reveal that like the FBI thinks that Mulder's dead, but the audience knows that Mulder is not dead at all, and there's no way that they're going to kill him off screen. And then you get like the build to the second half, to like, you know, Josepho trying to get Scully to bring him the head of Fox Mulder, and this idea of a prophecy that's tied up in Mulder and William, which sort of, in my mind, sort of like makes Scully, like, takes away Scully's agency, because she ends up like Scully's primary interest to most of the characters in the mythology is as a nexus point between William, who's a baby and who can't act and serve as the cornerstone of the mythology, and Mulder, who's played by David Duchovny, who at this point has made it clear he has no interest in coming back. And it just sort of, like, for me, that's what kind of grinds my gears with the two-parter, and what really sort of stops me getting on board. Which is a shame, because there is a lot of interesting stuff in here.
Yeah, I do have to differ with the idea of Scully and agency, because I think this is probably the only story arc or episode in the ninth season where, you know, Scully is really the driving force of the story. And, I mean, you know, she's beating up, you know, I love that fight
scene. Neil McDonough.
Neil McDonough, yeah. who's a terrific actor, and also from my part of the woods. She's fighting the FBI. She's defiant. She's taking charge in recovering her son. She's not relying on, you know, these people in the FBI who she doesn't know and doesn't trust. So the thing I like about Providence and Providence is that, you know, it's kind of a caper. There's a central theme. You know, the episode is essentially about, you know, the events leading up to the kidnapping of William, and then the recovery of William. So it's there aren't like 10 million subplots and characters running around. It's very Scully centric, and it's focused on, you know, the recovery of a son, and it's revisiting these themes from the sixth season, the end of the sixth season, and the beginning of the seventh season that they dropped. So it seems to me like I understand your criticism. I think there are very valid criticisms to make of these episodes. But at the same time, I think this is the only time in that ninth season where the X-Files mythology, you know, sort of was at least trying to recapture what made it work in the first place.
All right. Well, with that in mind, I'll be back tomorrow with Clara Cook talking about Providence and Audrey Pauly. But until then, remember, trust no one.